Well, as you've been reminded, our worship theme since mid-August has been the stewardship of money. And today, as our series finale, we consider this story in Luke 12, where a rich man tears down his small barns to build bigger barns to accommodate his abundant wealth. And we're asking the question of how, in light of this and other biblical texts about money, we should live. In other words, what does God want us to do with our wealth? Well, I'd be lying if I said I was particularly eager to address this question. My first thoughts were all reasons why it would be better to avoid this subject. One, the majority of you have excess wealth, enough to buy expensive things, take expensive trips, eat expensive food. And you likely didn't come here this morning to listen to me make you feel guilty about that. Two, relatively speaking, I too have a lot of wealth, and I'm really not keen on sounding like a hypocrite this morning. Three, there are a good number of you here who do not have a lot of money, and I don't mean those who think they don't have a lot but really are fairly financially secure. I mean those who truly struggle to make ends meet, and that divide among us is an uncomfortable one. Four, the values of capitalism and consumerism are so thoroughly ingrained in nearly all of us that we hardly know the depth of our assimilation. We struggle with any kind of response to this reality other than sporadic acts of charity, and in my case, overeating at the relief sale. And five, I know of no subject we are more reticent to talk about than how much money we take in and how much we give away. There are all kinds of other intimate, personal things we could be convinced to disclose before we utter to anyone our money secrets. The fear of shame and judgment in this area is just too great. So, is there anything to be gained by my preaching, or should I just sit down? Now, before you respond, I should note that was a rhetorical question. And in fact, I have sought to counter my initial hesitancy by coming up with five reasons for the other side, why my staying up here might actually be a good idea. One, as we've learned over the last month, it does seem like money is a fairly frequent topic in the Bible. So if we want to engage this book, we can't avoid it forever. Two, our avoidance of talking about money may actually be an important reason why we should be talking about it. If it's true that we are all half-blind, staggering through a moonless night on this topic, we may actually need each other to find our way forward. Three, how we use money signals something very significant about who we are and what our values are. Yes, there is nothing like money to unmask the truth about us. Four, it may be, it just might be, that there's actually some good news and freedom to be found in right relationship with money. And fifth, oh, what would be a fifth reason? Ah, yes, because at assembly, as tempting as it might be, we really can't talk about sex all the time. So now that I've named my hesitations and hopes, let's take a look at today's gospel story. The context here is Jesus talking to a crowd about living fearlessly, about not worrying how to defend oneself, not even dreading persecution or death. Instead, he says, we should live with confidence that our life belongs to God, who knows and cares for us with an intimacy we rarely appreciate. And in what seems like a non sequitur, someone from the crowd interrupts and says, hey, Jesus, tell my stupid brother to divide the family inheritance with me. You know, it's interruptions like these that amaze me that Jesus stuck by his nonviolent principles. Yet Jesus hears the fear in the man's request, that he won't get his share, that he won't have enough, and says, friend, I'm not here to help you secure your financial inheritance. Listen, all of you, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. And then Jesus tells the parable we've heard. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, what should I do, for I have no place to store these crops? And then he had an idea and said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample resources, so relax, eat some good food, drink some good drink, and be merry. But God intervened in this discussion between the rich man and his soul and said to him, you are a fool. Well, I'm not a farmer. My wealth hasn't been tied to crop production. But my household has had years of financial abundance, years where we take in more than is needed for the basic necessities of healthy food, modest clothing, and adequate shelter. So I've been in a similar predicament of this man with his abundance. And like him, I decided to store it, to build up a bigger bank account, get a CD, a 401k. And then I could say, I can relax. I can eat some good food. I can drink some good drink and maybe have myself a little fun. But God said to him, you fool. Really? What is so foolish? The man with abundance wasn't like Zacchaeus, who cheated people out of their money. All that seemingly happened here was some prudent financial planning, some careful money management. In other words, he didn't do anything much different than what I and a good many of you do all the time. So what's going on here? After God calls out the man as a fool, the parable concludes with this announcement from God to the man. This very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God. Now, some preachers hear that ending and conclude that the moral of the story is captured in the aphorism that one never sees a U-Haul trailer behind a hearse. And it's true. You can't take it with you. Life does sometimes end sooner than we can spend our 401k. Therefore, it may be better to invest less time behind the plow, work in the fields, and more time with family. But I don't find that a very satisfying or profound interpretation. I think we need to look further for the meaning here. Maybe back to Jesus' admonition at the beginning of the passage, that life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Because if that is true, then what does life consist of? Or put another way, what is the purpose of life? Now there's a more profound question. Some biblical scholars say that one out of every 10 verses in the Gospels is about material possessions, what we might call stuff. There are verses about having too much stuff, not having enough stuff, having trouble letting go of stuff, letting stuff become too important, loving stuff more than people, wanting stuff more than God. There are 100 variations on the theme, but what drives them all is the human quest for stuff. The late comedian George Carlin, known for his cutting social satire, had some keen observations about our modern obsession with accumulating more and more stuff. Stuff is important, he'd say. You got to take care of your stuff. You got to have a place for your stuff. That's what life's all about, trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is, a place to keep your stuff. If you didn't have so much stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You just walk around all the time. A house is just a pile of stuff with a cover on it. So now you got a house full of stuff. And even though you might like your house, you got to move. Got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. And that means you got to move all your stuff. Or maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Storage! Imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on other people's stuff. Well, as far as I know, George Carlin never went to seminary or even read the Bible. But he and Jesus seem to be on the same wavelength here, using a similar rhetorical strategy to jolt us out of our insanity. And I won't deny my part in it. My house holds a lot of stuff. And while I don't currently have a storage unit or a barn, I do have a nice big garage that Dana built. And because that's not enough, I also have a shed that Dale built. And I don't think my pile of stuff is excessive by community standards, but that's saying very little in such a materialistic culture. And to tell you the truth, some of my stuff makes me happy. Have I told you about my new bike? But theologian and writer Barbara Brown Taylor points out that what my stuff doesn't do is make me feel safe. It doesn't soothe my fearful heart in the middle of the night when I lie awake and wonder, what is the point of this life I'm living? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my one wild and precious life? Or am I too often distracted, numbed, tempted away from living a faithful and meaningful life? These are dangerous questions, because we live in a culture that sees nothing wrong with letting stuff and the accumulation of shinier, faster stuff consume our days. In fact, our culture depends on it. We're told that if the economy slows down, that's because some of us are not spending enough on stuff. And if we don't buy more stuff, then businesses will fail and salaries will dry up. We won't be able to buy more stuff. Our country needs us to build more barns. It's the American way of life. Or is it just so much foolishness in the eye of God? Taylor thinks that the rich man in our story is a fool, not so much because his barns are getting too big, although that may be part of the problem, but because his purpose in life is getting too small. He has fallen for the cultural myth that accumulating stuff was a big enough purpose for human life on earth. And as a result, he will die without ever having really lived. He may have an impressive barn, but he's got a puny soul. Warnings about wealth are essential to Jesus. No one can serve two masters, he said, for you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Elsewhere, he said, seeds sown among thorns are like those choked with worries and riches and pleasures of this life. They bring no fruit to maturity. Still elsewhere, he said, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God. The gospel's incessant concern about wealth and possessions comes from an awareness that they are a grave threat to our soul. They provoke our anxiety. They separate us from our neighbors. They compete for our worship. And if we gain an abundance, they lead us to think we no longer need God. They drive the most powerful idol that exists, greed. Greed is that insatiable desire for more. More than is enough. It's the human propensity to focus the longing and the search for a meaningful life on having more things, more wealth, more power. Self-interest is its cardinal virtue. Lack of self-control, its primary symptom. Greed is inherently anti-community, and it corrupts the poor as easily as it does the rich, although the consequences are more confined. So, how do we withdraw our allegiance from this idol of greed and live a life rich toward God? The parable doesn't give us an answer. It just tells us we have a problem. But because I like practical suggestions, I will offer some for your consideration. I think if we want to live in contrast to the worldly ways of greed, we need to give attention to three key aspects of financial stewardship: giving, consuming, and economic justice. Each one could easily be a sermon on its own, and you've heard preachers in this series focus on pieces. But I want to give a broad overview because I think they're essential parts for this question of how we should live. So first is giving. Giving is first and foremost not what we do, but what a loving Creator does, with human beings the receivers of the gift. God gives life, ecological richness, and enough sustenance for all to thrive. But the extraordinary gift meant to be shared and circulated has too often been mistaken for a possession to be owned. And recognizing this danger, Scripture directs us toward regular giving. This giving is joyful participation in the gift economy of God, and it's one act of rebellion we can take against the godless culture of accumulation. So cultivating a regular pattern of giving is an important entry step into generous living, a good place to start at any age and any stage of life. Is tithing 10% of our income to our faith community and organizations we hold dear. And as our spirit of giving grows, so too should our tithe. Some, I know, add a percent each year. A deeper step still is to consider how much wealth and income is enough. This question of what is enough is almost unheard of in our culture, but it's a serious question in the Bible. A number of years ago, the Conference Board, a nonprofit economic research organization, said that an average American household spends around $40,000 on necessities. So what might one do with income above that amount, above what is enough? Maybe donate a higher percentage of that income, 20%, 50%. Or as philosopher Peter Singer suggests, give nearly all of this excess income to help the world's poor. Second, any serious reckoning of economic stewardship also needs to examine our patterns of consumption. Despite the growing decriminalization of marijuana in the United States, shopping still seems to be our favorite high, our nationally sanctioned addiction. And for ecological reasons alone, some serious detox is needed. First world levels of consumption far exceed the Earth's capacity. But there are compelling spiritual reasons as well. There seems to be a strong correlation between detachment from material possessions and spiritual growth. It's why many of the spiritual giants live with less things or even in voluntary poverty. Now, few of us are ready to take vows of poverty yet, but we would do well to recognize how our possessions shape and change who we are and our desires and our ways of thinking. So we can begin by choosing to consume more prudently. For some, that may mean participating in a buy-nothing Christmas or a shopping sabbatical, like a year of no new clothing. We can also consider how we can consume more ethically, understanding that what we purchase promotes particular values. If we want to advance environmental sustainability, livable wages, or humane farming, we can go beyond just looking for bargains, and also to the conscience of businesses from whom we purchase. Finally, a stewardship of money that is biblically based must include a lived-out concern for the poor. The biblical prophets make clear that if the poor, the oppressed, and the downtrodden don't matter to you, then clearly God doesn't matter to you either. To live a religious life, says Rabbi Shea held, is to want the vulnerable to flourish and to work to make that possible. This starts with advocating or supporting organizations who advocate for the needs of people with low income. And some may take this step deeper through regular engagement with a ritual of fasting, as both a call to prayer and a reminder of the many for whom not eating is not ritual, but life. And then asking oneself, what are you obligated to do in response to their suffering? As one grows yet deeper into this realm of economic justice, one sees more ways to tie your focus and your fate with the fate of the poor. So, There you have it. Three essential foci and a handful of ideas about how to live out a stewardship of money. You may want to expand on that in small group discussions and share what commitments you're willing to make. But let us start our engagement mindful that we are utter fools when we live deeply caught in cycles of greed and affluence and self-indulgence and acquisitiveness of a fearful kind that yields no human future. The purposeful life is found through singing a new song. The world resists such a song, but those of us who come to God's table of abundance are called to sing of a new governance. This is a song of regime change. It's a song of generosity and justice, and its notes carry a staggering moral force, which has the power to break the spell of death. May we, through our stewardship of money, find the courage to sing along. Amen.